Danzig Radio Network of Stations.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. And Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serves its own needs. Dummies serve your own needs. Beat it up and not speak. Grunt no strength. Doesn't matter. Starts to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire in a fire. Representing seven games in a government for hire. The fury's beating down your neck. Keep my team reporters, Babel Trump, Jazzy Croft. Look at that, no claim. Fine, then. Uh-oh, overflow. Population common, but it'll do. Shake yourself, serve yourself. World serves its own needs. Listen to your heartbeat. Dummy, Mr. Rancher is the reverend in the right. Right, you patriotic, patriotic. Slam, fight, right. I feel it, pretty sight.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate. Automotive, incinerate, light a candle, light a motor, step down, step down. Watching heel, crush, crush, uh-oh, this means no fear. Cavalier, renegade, steer clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll-free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@ipsmediaworks.net. There is a video chat room to see James in action as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Janczyk.
Well, well, it's not actually the end of the world, but you'll hear when we talk with our next guest why I chose that bumper. Because it is all fine. It is part of a system that sends super galactive waves that puff out. A puff would be a good word, except the size is humongous. From the center of the galaxy, and it ripples throughout the galaxy, and it does things. It not only does it mess up things, but it also promotes and creates things. It's one of the many things that our next guest, Paul LaViolette, talked about. He's the author of Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion, Subquantum Kinetics, Earth Under Fire, Genesis of the Cosmos, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars, Galactic Superwaves, and Their Impact on the Earth. He's the editor of A Systems View of Man. He has also published many original papers in physics, astronomy, climatology, systems theory, and psychology. He received a BA in physics from Johns Hopkins, an MBA from the University of Chicago, a PhD from Portland State University, and is currently the president of Starburst Foundation. That's starburstfound.org. Recognized in the marquee's Who's Who in Science and Engineering, Dr. LaViolette is the first to predict the high-intensity volley of cosmic ray particles that travel directly to our planet from distant sources in our galaxy. Also the first to discover high concentrations of cosmic dust in the ice age polar ice, indicating the occurrence of a global cosmic catastrophe in ancient times. Based on this work, he made predictions about the entry of interstellar dust into the solar system 10 years before it was confirmed in 1993 by data from the Ulysses spacecraft and by radar observations in New Zealand. He also originated the glacier wave flood theory that not only provides a reasonable scientific explanation for widespread continental floods, but also presents a credible explanation for the sudden freezing of the Arctic mammoths and the demise of the Pleistocene mammals. He also developed a novel theory that links geomagnetic flips to the past occurrences of immense solar flares. I mention all these things because what I really like about the next guest is that his work has predicted these things that current science has confirmed before they themselves, will say, believed it. Also, his work, as we will see, overturns many things in current science. So he's one of these guys that has the brains and the material to back up the claims which are being confirmed. Unfortunately, since it appears science is only looking for things that confirm what is already considered to be fact, it's not necessarily embracing these things universally. And hopefully that'll change soon. And I want to welcome Paul LaViolette to being on the show to talk about these things. And welcome, Paul.
Very happy to be here.
Yes, boy, I tell you, I have a million questions, but I guess first we should start off for people who haven't actually heard about this. Could you put into a view of what are exactly our galactic waves in kind of a nutshell?
Just a cosmic ray volleys or explosions from the center of our galaxy. Center is about 23,000 light years away, but even though it's so far away, it can have a major effect on us. Think of it as sort of like a volcano that's out there. We're circling around it. Our solar system circles around the center of the galaxy about every 250 million years. But the center is not that calm. It periodically goes through this outburst stage where it becomes very active. And when that happens, when all that energy comes through our solar system, it's sort of like a galactic storm, everything becomes completely different from what we're used to. Right now, we're in the in-between period, in between the storm, so to speak. And it affects the Earth's climate. In the past, I mean, it's a cyclic event, so we've seen what it's done in the past. It's aggravated the sun to an extent that it caused the extinction of a large number of mammals about 13,000 years ago. It has a gravity wave component associated with it, so it can cause seismic effects on the Earth. So it has a large number of things that it can do.
Well, maybe we could do it this way. So we're sitting outside looking at the night sky. And if you could walk us through a gravity wave hit, I keep saying gravity, a galactic super wave hitting the Earth, our area, let's say. And what would it look like as it occurs? And also perhaps even start, why does it even happen? Why does the center of the galaxy erupt?
Right. Okay. It takes us by surprise because it's traveling towards us the speed of light. So we don't see it coming until it arrives. We in modern times have not been through this type of event. The last large-scale event happened ended around 11,000 years ago. There was a small event around 5,300 years ago, and then there may.
Hello? Hello, hello.
Would see is the first sign would probably be the seismic disturbance of the Earth. Could probably trigger earthquakes, major earthquakes we're talking about.
So the earthquakes would actually happen prior to us experiencing the light radiation?
I believe so, yeah.
Now, is that because
the gravity wave would sort of propagate ahead of the cosmic rays? It would get a head start. It would actually be in the beginning as the core was exploding. The core of a galaxy is what a lot of scientists talk about as a black hole, but not everyone agrees with the black hole idea. The main thing is it's a very massive object, 6 million times more massive than our own sun. When it explodes, it sort of, there's a gravitational disturbance that would come out actually at superluminal speed initially, and then slow down to light speed. So this would give it a slight head start. It could trigger earthquakes at least as strong as what happened with the tsunami in 2004, probably even greater. The thing is that we have not experienced one of these things, so you can only guess about what would be the magnitude of the earthquakes.
The thing we're talking about this is that every time you make a statement, there's about a whole bunch of statements around it. And within this statement about the core exploding and the potential of it not being a black hole, that's one whole discussion. And then the gravity waves starting out ahead of speed, faster than light, that's a whole other discussion. And
right.
Then, you know, so it's kind of hard. I'm going to end up bouncing around as we go here, but I'm trying to get kind of a map of
maybe
this process.
Maybe we could come back to those.
Yeah,
come
right,
back
right,
to those
right.
Points. So to go on with what you'd experience, the next thing you'd see is a very bright bluish-white star in the sky that wasn't there before. And it would be located where we see the galactic core. Well, we don't really see the galactic core today. Only with radio telescopes can we see where it's actually located. The reason being there's a lot of cosmic dust that obscures the core from our sight. It's in a general area where the galactic bulge is, the main central bulge of stars in the galaxy. But during a core explosion, the core would become at least a million times brighter than it is currently. So it would be bright enough that, the main part of the light would actually be coming from the cosmic rays that were thrown out by the explosion. And they produce what's called synchrotron radiation, which is a bluish-white light in the visible, but it also includes radio wave emission, gamma ray emission, X-ray. So it's all across the board, also, you know. You'd see this bluish-white core that you hadn't seen before in the sky, and it's actually, there are legends that talk about this. The Hopis have a legend about the bluish-white star appearing in the sky, which heralds the cataclysm. Then as the cosmic rays arrived, you'd see them creating sort of luminous effects around the solar system, because the solar system is in a magnetic field sheath, and these cosmic rays would sort of get caught in that and give off light. They'd also start vaporizing cosmic debris that's out there. It's normally in ice form. but the intensity in the heliopause, which is this cosmic ray envelope around the solar system, the intensity of the cosmic rays would get high enough to actually start vaporizing this cometary material and create a nebula around the solar system and push this stuff into the solar system. In fact, the magnetic field sheath that's around the solar system could actually become compressed inward as close as orbit of Mars or Jupiter. And this dust would start coming in around the sun, the moon. It would start looking like Halloween in true nature, you know. In fact, the Druids commemorate October 31st for the past of cataclysms that happened to the Earth. So the tradition of jack-o'-lanterns and witches going through the sky might actually be a remembrance of these sort of weird, eerie effects that people were seeing in space. Right across the board, there's, if you look in all different spiritual texts and legends, they talk about the stars being darkened from the sky and moon being darkened or turned red in the sun. And so this could be a reference to the cosmic dust that would be coming in. These effects would lag later, you know. They would come, I would say, would take several months for this cosmic dust to start coming in. Right at the forefront of this, you would have an EMP also, electromagnetic pulse, and that could do some major damage to our electrical conduction network, the power lines, these million-volt power lines that we have going across continents would tend to pick up this energy, and it could fry the step-down transformers. This has been even a major concern for the recently the National Academy of Science has put out a report of how currently our electrical system isn't protected from a major solar flare, similar to what happened about 150 years ago. It was called the Carrington event. Something like a superwave could even be more disastrous as far as the EMP goes. And currently, we're not prepared for it. You know, if you can imagine the utility grid transformers going down, and they might have one or two spares, but, you know, maybe they need 100. And so they'd be caught with not having replacements.
On that note, if I can interject, my brother works for the power grid in the area, and he has told me over the years they used to have super redundancy, and they used to replace equipment before it broke and all that. And in cost-causing matters now, the equipment they have is so old, and they don't have spares or replacements, that if there ever was a bad heat wave, he said, it would go down, let alone what we were talking about.
Yeah. Now, this is a report that was put out just this year in January by the National Academy of Sciences. You can find it on the Internet. In fact, I have it here. Severe space weather events, it's called. You can actually download it for free from the Internet. And they estimated that that society could actually be without electricity for many years, like 3 or 4 years a minimum, and maybe as much as 10 years. That being the time required to repair the electrical grid. And it's sort of, the whole thing cascades, because if you don't have electricity, you can't pump gas, you can't get food to the stores, you can't produce pharmaceuticals. And so this is something, if it happened like just a solar flare, like the one that we had in 1859, if something like that happened today, we're talking about an economic disaster, at least, much bigger than we're having the past year or two, just from that. So a similar, we should be concerned that a similar thing could happen with a superwave.
And it could happen, you know, in spades. It can happen in big time, because from what I understand of hearing this, the dust coming in with the sun. Actually, the sun, wouldn't that be the bigger culprit in affecting us rather than the wave itself? It's like the wave affects the sun, it affects the dust in the area, and then the sun does its thing and then affects us and so on.
Right. In fact, if we didn't have this frozen debris around the solar system, if we happened to have been, let's say, in a clean part of the galaxy and a superwave came through, it would be a lot more benign than one that came through now, because we're being partially engulfed by a supernova remnant. Astronomers have talked about it being possibly related to what's called the North Polar Spur. This is a supernova that went off at least 1 million or 2 million years ago, and the shell is, of material is just there in space, and we're happen to be passing through an edge of it. So what that does is it sort of stocks the solar system environs with all this debris. And in fact, the long period comets that come hurtling in every so often are due to the fact we're going through this field of debris right now. Once this dust is pushed in, that normally it's kept out by the solar wind, but during a superwave event, you're going to get this stuff being pushed in. It's going to aggravate the sun. Let's say it continues to come in for a century or so. The sun will start acting up like it did 13,000 years ago. You know, we see carbon-14 levels started going up because the Earth was getting bombarded by coronal mass ejections, much more intense than we see today. In fact, there was an extinction level event, I believe. I'm writing a paper about this now. I found evidence that mammoths and the large mammals that became extinct 12,900 years ago, there was evidence that it was due to a very large solar flare hitting the Earth, a coronal mass ejection. And I think I've located actually in the ice core record where this has been recorded, so we can do further investigation. As you say, the sun makes the whole thing much worse as the sun gets in an energized, aggravated state. And you'll see a lot of reference to this in the myths. In my book, Earth Under Fire, I go into a lot of the ancient legends besides presenting astronomical and geological evidence. I also look at the myths because I believe that you can learn a lot by looking at these myths. These are people that went through this experience, and they passed down knowledge of this to future generations through the myths.
If I can stop there for a second, you mentioned about the long-term comets being on a cycle. What kind of cycle, in how many years? Is that because the galactic wave pushes them in as it goes through, or kind of skirts them along, and then they start a cycle, and then therefore the cycle would kind of coincide with the galactic wave cycle?
No, I wouldn't say there's a cycle for the long-period comets. They're just coming in at random as we go through this field of debris.
Okay.
Scientists have found that they tend to enter from the direction in which the solar system is moving through the galaxy.
Okay.
So let's say consider it like a north pole for the solar system in its direction it moves through the galaxy. So from that direction, you find these comets are coming in. The cycle is more the core explosion cycle. It's something from the core that's 23,000 light years away. It has a cycle that we're just beginning to learn about it, I guess. You can infer the time between these events by looking in the ice record. We've drilled cores in Greenland and Antarctica, going down several kilometers, and it goes back in time. In the case of Antarctica, it goes back like 400,000 years or more. And scientists have studied what's called beryllium 10, which is a radioactive element produced in the atmosphere. And by looking at the peaks of that element, you can judge what was the time between these events.
Okay, well, just hold on for there. We'll stop there, we'll take a break and come back and pick it right up. We are talking about the galactic superwave, which will touch in many side issues with our guest, Paul LaViolette, who has written many books on the subject. We'll continue with your questions as well after the break. We're going to let him lay down the map, per se, and then go back and talk about the various components. Fascinating stuff. We'll be right back after this. Are you getting your greens? I'm James Othianchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Innerfood by Inner Health Botanicals. Innerfood is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Innerfood is spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, spinach, alfalfa, barley, wheatgrass, rosehip, beetroot, and much more in real amounts, not just a sprinkle to fill out an inflated but impotent list of ingredients. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Innerfood is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, feedtofire.com, and click on any InnerHealth Botanical banner and you're ready to order. Or call 866-762-9238 and be sure to mention you heard them on Feet to the Fire. Innerfood, building health from the insides out. I'm James Othianchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio and creator and host of Feet to the Fire. Have you ever noticed the high volume of commercials on most talk shows? It is to the point that it seems like topics are the bait and the guests are the fillers to sell products. I've made a conscious decision to keep disruptions to a minimum and provide more uninterrupted time for the real reason you tuned in. You hear guests with more time to make their points, allowing me and listeners to intuitively and intelligently formulate questions by having less interruptions to break the stream of consciousness. Feet to the Fire may be free to listen to, but it's not free to provide. We rely heavily on donations to offset the expenses of producing the show. If you like what we are doing and enjoy the show, why not consider donating via PayPal or a major credit card from our website, feedtofire.com, or send your check or money order to Feet to the Fire, 1147 Brook Forest Avenue, Suite 162, Shorewood, Illinois, 60404. Thank you. Most people think of addictions relating to drugs, alcohol, and tobacco. However, obsessive-compulsive actions taken to excessive levels have the same biochemical goal. They stimulate the creation of natural feel-good hormones, but at a cost that causes more harm in the long run. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com.
Make sure you stay tuned, because you're listening to Feet to the Fire.
Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organic seed packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A one-pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed two people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The family pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of four. There's even a homestead pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed eight people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
How about 23,000 years? Light years. I mean, we don't have to go. We don't have to go outside our galaxy to have catastrophe. And it's funny how science just totally ignores catastrophe theories. It talks about the mountains being there for thousands of millions of years. I drove through those Rockies. Those babies were pushed up there, I'd say in minutes, and I believe it. I mean, that was amazing force of stuff. And yet there seems to be this science kind of avoids this whole idea of catastrophe. I don't know if it's sticking your head in the sand or whatnot. But our guest, Paula Violette, has not only talked about how this happens, that it happens, proves that it happened, but also the mechanism that it happens so that we can prepare for it and not be caught off guard. And welcome back to the show, Paul.
Hi.
And you were saying about the isotopes in the cores showing that there was some very extra-normal activity going on.
Yeah, the beryllium-10 is produced by the cosmic rays as they impact our atmosphere. And this goes on even today. We're bombarded by cosmic rays from our galaxy and from other galaxies. But as you look back in time, you see there were these peaks. Judging from the time between the peaks, you can kind of figure what is the periodicity. I took this ice core data and gave it to some people in Washington who were helping out the Starburst Foundation. The Starburst Foundation is my research institute. And these people in the financial world actually are used to crunching numbers for looking at stock market trends and so on. And they were able to do like a Fourier analysis of this data. And you find that there's certain periods in the data. One is around 28,000 years, another is around 11,500 years, and another one's around 5,700 years, which is this shorter period is closer to the Mayan calendar cycle. The Mayan calendar cycle is around 5,126 years. And so you can actually learn a lot about what happened to the Earth in the past by looking at the ice. It's, it's like a frozen record of everything that's happened. The other thing is to look for cosmic dust, because if a superwave was impacting in the past, it would have pushed cosmic dust into the solar system, and you'd find it falling from the sky, and eventually it would be captured in the ice record. And that was what I had done for a test of the theory, was to look for high levels of cosmic dust in the ice. And I did find several peaks between 35,000 and 70,000 years old. I was originally wanting to look at the end of the ice age when I believe this past superwave, this large superwave, the most recent one, had affected us. But the ice in that part of the record had already been sampled. There were other ice cores drilled later, but the problem was convincing the scientific community that this was a feasible study. Even with the positive data that I had found, I couldn't bring the scientific community out of their frame of mind to consider that this was a plausible phenomenon, to actually look. They didn't even want to look.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, is there some unspoken agreement that all these catastrophes happened well in the past and we're in a boring, long stretch of nothing? Is it wishful thinking? Is it being blind? Is there some kind of unwritten rule? Don't scare people. Keep this.
I think so. because catastrophism can make people scared. And science is not supposed to. There's no place for emotion in science, you know, sort of like the Dr. or Mr. Spock approach, you know. But to be realistic, we have to realize that there is no paper bag around the Earth that protects us. You know, we are affected by things in space. And we should be open to investigating this. I don't say that all scientists are that way. There are a lot of people looking at these things, like, for example, the idea that an asteroid could hit the Earth. The team at Berkeley that discovered that an asteroid had hit the Earth 65 million years ago, at the time of the dinosaur extinction, they made a big step forward. And but they also had resistance from the geological community, who were not used to people outside their field coming and telling them, you know, here's something from space that can affect the Earth. They were used to thinking in terms of volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and that sort of thing. So, you know, you do find it's sort of a battle going on. People are trying to bring these new ideas in, and they're often resisted.
Right. Well, on this aspect of this whole cycle, this is, well, I'm going through a bunch of my notes here. One of the things I liked about what you were saying is that we look at this cycle as a destruction cycle, but you had mentioned that this energy being interjected into, or should say, out of the galactic sun is actually necessary for matter and life and so forth to continue.
Right.
And maybe perhaps you can talk a little bit about your theory of what you recalled the ether.
Okay. Well, the ether theory I have developed, first let me say that there is a lot of evidence for the existence of an ether, although in the university and academia, they're still teaching that only special relativity is correct, and that there's no place for an ether. Believe me, there's a lot of physicists who favor the ether theory, even though academia continues to teach relativity. For example, if you were to just use relativity to try to synchronize the galactic positioning system, the GPS system that's used, you'd end up getting wrong answers for where people are located on the surface of the Earth. And the military has recognized that, and they pay one company huge sums of money to give them the right equations, which are not relativistic. They're based on the idea of an ether. Also, every time you take a jet plane, your plane's guided by what's called a ring laser, which is a sort of a reproduction of the Sagnac experiment from the 30s. Sagnac was a French scientist. And he showed let's say you have lasers in a ring. If you spin the ring, the light beams that go in the direction of spinning will actually go faster than the ones that go in the opposite direction against the spinning direction of the ring. And so this, again, violates relativity and proves the existence of the ether. So anyway, I developed a new kind of ether theory, which is based on ideas from systems concepts, ideas we see in the field of chemical kinetics, and I've brought these ideas into microphysics field. And when you bring these ideas in, it completely changes how you view the physical world. But for one thing, you don't have a Big Bang explosion. With this cosmology, it predicts a cosmology. First of all, let me say it's a unified field theory. It satisfies that requirement. And it's extremely simple. It's just like you write five equations, and that gives you everything. And you might wonder, how is it just from five equations can you simulate the entire physical reality? The reason is that it's a what's called a nonlinear open reaction system. Whenever you have nonlinear systems, you can get extremely complex behavior out of a very simple set of equations. This has been a different approach from the way physics has gone, which has been sort of like the blind man and the elephant, which using observations to look at just a very narrow set of data and create a theory. And then they end up creating a number of different theories like relativity, electrodynamics, Newton's laws. And then somebody else tries to weave these together to form what they call unified field theory. But still, in the end, you end up with a patchwork quilt. The nice thing about subquantum kinetics is that it's unified right from the start. One thing it's got going for it is that so far it's made 12 predictions that have been subsequently verified, which is far more than Einstein's theory had done. Einstein had 3 predictions that were verified. So these are predictions that I had published in referee journals, and they were different from what was believed at the time, but later data came out that supported it. And really, this is the way you should judge a theory, is can it make predictions that are valid and,
oh, yeah,
and are supported?
It's a very, I mean, that's a very kind of a concrete way. If you can predict what is going to happen, and then it's that's kind of a long-standing scientific thing. I just get very angry. I mean, I grew up in the science. I love sciences, and math and science is my thing through high school, college. And I thought that science was this search for truth, and that all, you know, whatever would come up, it's verified, and okay, fine. And then I realized one day that science is a religion. I mean, there are people who believe certain things, and they rule out certain data, and especially if you're going to give any credit to the ancients of knowing anything, they just rule out these points of view and data and keep what's in it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, actually, subquantum kinetics is closer to the ancient view of the universe. It recognizes that the basis of existence is flux, is change. Whereas it's physics is based on the idea of structure. You know, if you go down to the smallest level, physicists talk about particles and force pulling them together. So it's sort of like a little tinker toy set is what you come up with. You know, the ancient view was the idea of transformation, flux, and from flux you can get structure. Because if you have a process of change that goes into a loop, then the loop form is something that persists, and you can call that a structure, a system. So that's the beauty of this approach. It's more fundamental, and it's more universal. I mean, the same approach that you're taking to physics is similar to the approach which you find in biology and sociology. The idea of looking at things as open systems. In other words, like we're open systems. We have to breathe and inhale, exhale. We have inputs and outputs. And if those inputs and outputs were to cease, we would die. No, the system would deteriorate. And that fundamental truth is not accepted in physics traditionally. And that's what subquantum kinetics has done, is to bring these ideas into physics.
You violate, like, one of the most basic laws of conservation of energy. You're saying that energy moves in the universe and moves out of the universe, and it's actually needed to move in and out of the universe. In fact, the universe exists because of the energy moving in and moving out.
Well, that's close, but at that level, you're dealing at the flux is at the etheric level, and you don't talk about energy at that level.
Okay.
Energy
okay.
is something that's physical, and sure. you have to come up with new words. It's like energy in the sense that I sometimes use the word etheric force or action, something like that.
We really do need a new vocabulary for this because of the basic. And, oh, let me ask you now. I've been reading about the string theory. Could the strings, quote unquote, be kind of like the ether, or should they retune it to the ether? Are the strings a result of the ether, or really there's no relationship?
Well, to be honest, I haven't wasted my time with string theory. For one thing, it's an outgrowth of general relativity, and relativity is extremely limited. There's a lot of experiments I can talk about where would be disproving general relativity. For one thing, general relativity predicts that you can only have gravitational attraction, when in fact it's possible to have gravitational repulsion as well.
Anti-gravitons?
Anti-gravity. Well, not anti-gravitons, but you can. Gravity has two polarities. At least in subquantum kinetics predicts this, that gravity is bipolar, just like electricity is bipolar, and it's correlated with electrical charge, and that there is a connection between electric charge and gravity. Einstein was trying to unify, you know, his theory, somehow find a connection between electricity and gravity, but he failed. Subquantum kinetics predicts it. In fact, I was when I was working on the theory, I was a little at first cautious because I saw that, well, it leads to bipolar gravity connected with electric polarity. And then I became very relieved when I discovered the work of Townsend Brown, who had done experiments on this. And in fact, his technology sort of went underground and surfaced in the B-2 bomber. I believe the B-2 bomber uses his technology. I discussed this in my recent book, Secrets of Anti-Gravity Propulsion. It technically, in the aerospace field, this whole field of technology is called field propulsion. In other words, using electric or gravity fields to propel a craft. It's not, unfortunately, it's not taught in universities, in aerospace technology in universities. It's most of the work's done in black programs or classified programs that are run by some of the major aerospace companies. You found a lot of aerospace companies dabbling in this field. Back in the 50s, at that time, there was no suppression in the literature. There were magazine, newspaper articles about this going on. And then around 1958-59, there was a news blackout on this, and none of the media were reporting it. But believe it, we are in the Star Wars field as far as aerospace propulsion. You know, it's just not used commercially.
Now, one thing that bothered me about Einstein, it wasn't. I mean, what bothered? I mean, I'm not a physics. I wasn't trained in physics. But one thing that bothered about me was the idea of the limit the speed of light had to stay at that time froze at that time, and the constant, the constants and so on. It seemed like, the way I looked at it, it's hard to put into words. It looked like it worked because we made this box, and that what we saw from within the box was relativity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but there was a bunch of other stuff we didn't see, but the reason why it worked to a degree and liked it to a degree is that you kept it within a view of it. I mean, it's a very unscientific way to put it, but is relativity just completely wrong, or was it, because of a certain view that was being looked at, it worked a certain way?
Yeah, if you ignore certain experiments, you can say, yeah, relativity works. If you look at the data against it, and the experiment, there's a lot of experiments, that the only way to explain it is that there's an absolute reference frame, that there is, there are no relative frames. Now, in subquantum kinetics, you get relativistic effects. In other words, so like time dilation as you go faster and faster relative to the ether. You get length contraction. You get gravitational time dilation. You get the bending of starlight near a star. You get all these effects that you get in general and special relativity. In effect, those effects are corollaries of these basic equations that I was telling you about.
Okay, all right. Because, I mean, it would be kind of weird that they were just, like, completely off. I mean, because it does work to some degree. It's just you got to kind of step back in a frame to see a bigger picture, to see more information. And so it's like they could be so close, but so far, but so close all at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, but hold on. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back to continue talking with Paul LaViolette about gravity waves, about the effects as it comes to the planet, but also actually getting into the whole aspect of the physics that he is bringing in to the world, which can be described as subquantum kinetics. We'll be right back after this. You are listening to this program on the IPS network of affiliate stations. Stay tuned for some local affiliate information. All right, the phones are now cleared and open to take the next caller for our prize giveaway, sponsored by Margie's Beef and Gyros Restaurant in Westmont, Illinois. You must be 18 years or older and have to pick up your prize in person at Margie's within 30 days. The odds are great. The trick is simple. Just call in, and if we answer the phone, you win. 888-863-2722 is that number. When you eat at Margie's, you are a winner every time with their great food and good deals, like their special discount for cash buyers. Every Monday and Tuesday from 3 p.m. till 9 p.m., an order over $30 paid with cash receives an instant discount of $6. It is a great way to break the boring microwave dinner routine without breaking your bank. And this is not a limited selection of items. This cash discount applies to anything they offer. And while you're there, don't forget to pick up the special coupon book with $126 in meal savings from now till December 2010. The coupon book is free, the deals are real, and the food is great. Like me, do you prefer vegetarian or vegan items? Margie's has you covered with sandwiches and dinners made to order. Margie's is located at 6410 South Cass Avenue, just south of 63rd Street on Cass Avenue in Westmont, Illinois. Their phone number is 630-852-3260. Better yet, just surf over to eatatmargies.com for all the information you need, from menus to videos. Remember to call in at 888-863-2722 and win every hour on the hour at Feet to Fire. Choose from a prize list that includes a Hamilton Beach delicate clothes dryer that doubles as a great house fan, a Hamilton Beach blender, a Homedic Shiatsu massager, an infrared massager, percussion massager, a paper shredder, speakerphone, 33-piece kitchen combo set, cookware set, stainless steel flask, inkjet printer cartridges, power stapler, durable ring binder, plus more. View pictures and description of the prizes at duraprint.com. Simply click on the radio show video archives and links button on the left menu, and then click list of prizes with detailed descriptions on the right-hand list. That's at duraprint.com. You can choose one prize valued at $50 to $100. You must be 18 years or older, and you have to pick up your prize in person at Margie's within 30 days. One of each prize on the list is available each show. The odds are great. The trick is simple. Call now, and if we answer the phone, you win. 888-863-2722. Call it and win. From Feet to Fire, Duraprint.com, and Margie's Beef and Gyros on the web at www.eatatmargies.com.
Feet to Fire is a production of IPS Media Works on the OnSIG Radio Network of Stations. Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll-free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yoncik.
Well, make it burned up by the sun. Well, you know, I guess it's fast enough. You got to go sometime. You know, we're all going to die eventually, so it's why we're here. We're trying to learn what it makes everything tick. And one thing good about, I think fabulous about our guest theories is that while science, and of course we'll probably never get time to get into this, but science seems to be driving religion and spirituality away from us, if you could say, false theories that have this ether that vibrates to create things and so forth, it kind of leaves it open to have a creator, be it collective or not, and to have the influence come from outside the universe into the universe and so on. Also, Paul has no problem dealing with extraterrestrials and whatnot and talking about it. And that's one of the things I like talking with you, Paul, is because you're not only do you have a solid science background, but you're not afraid to go into these other areas and question with that same kind of openness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool. Well, anyway, we left off. I don't want to cut you off in the middle there. We go through the breaks.
We were talking about relativity. I've seen an experiment where shock front pulses were sent much faster than the speed of light. Like I think it was the average speed was like 1.5 times the speed of light, but actually very close to the shock emitter, it was 2 or 3 times the speed of light. So I participated with researcher Guy Obolansky in taking the data, and so I've seen this firsthand, and it's it pretty much destroys relativity, this type of proof. The other thing is the speed of light with regular, now these are shock fronts, they're not regular light waves or radio waves, they're you might call it electric discharges, where you charge up a capacitor bank to very high voltage, like 300,000 volts, and then you discharge it to a dome electrode. It's not something you'd want to try in your garage. But this it's sort of like the technology that Tesla was using. It's basically a Tesla wave producer. Produces a longitudinal wave rather than a transverse wave. And these can be superluminal very close to the emitter. In addition, another example is speed of light. Even if you use regular radio waves or light waves, they found the speed of light is slowly changing. And this may be because the potential of gravity in the galaxy is changing, but it's a real effect. The physics of subquantum kinetics, another thing about it is that it leads to a continuous creation cosmology. Both matter and energy are continuously created. Now this violates one of the laws of physics, the first law of thermodynamics. But we're talking about a level that's like 10 orders of magnitude smaller than you could observe in the laboratory. Still, physicists would like to everything to be perfect. they have this undying faith in the first law, and so they get riled when you talk about even such small amounts that they can't disprove what you're saying. But it goes against their framework. But if you acknowledge this, you find that all the matter in the universe can be continuously generated. You don't need a Big Bang explosion. And it turns out that the place in our galaxy, for example, and in every galaxy, the place where it's the greatest or fastest rate of generation of matter is in the core. And like what we touched on before about the core explosions, this is a process of continuous creation, and it's sort of like a reactor that goes out of control at certain times. The rate of creation will get so high that it will go through this explosive phase and eject this material. And so, like we said, these superwaves are part of the normal creation process that's going on in our galaxy and in other galaxies. So the Big Bang theory was close to the right idea in that you do have Big Bangs, but it's not a single Big Bang, it's many. It's a continual process. And that's what gives the spiral galaxy its spiral form. You're not only having rotation of stars around the core, but you also have these explosive outbursts that sort of propel the arms out. If there wasn't this outward force, the arms would wrap up over time. This is something that has been noted by astronomers, that by themselves, the arms would tend to wrap up in a spiral galaxy. So this very nicely solves that problem.
Well, let me ask you then. So when we look at, say, a quasar, is that just we happen to take a picture of a galaxy that's in a core eruption? are a major core
exactly.
eruption? Okay.
Yes.
And thus,
in fact, the quasar would be an extreme eruption. The core of our galaxy, at least in the past years, it doesn't come anywhere close to a quasar eruption. Each galaxy, you know, has a different kind of core. Our core is relatively small. 8 million solar masses is small by comparison. Like, for example, some of these big elliptical galaxies can have cores that are a billion solar masses. And when those things erupt, they can produce a quasar-type outburst. Quasar outburst could be 1,000 times more intense than a Seyfert galaxy-type outburst.
So actually, they're not farther away. That's the misnomer because of the redshift. And you explained that the redshift is because the light is tired?
Right. In the subquantum kinetics predicts a tired light effect, which means that photons from distant galaxies will lose energy as they travel. And as a photon loses energy, its wavelength increases, which means it goes more towards the reddish part of the spectrum. And this is a gradual process. This is a different interpretation compared to the Big Bang theory, the expanding universe theory, which interprets the redshift of galaxies as due to a recession of the galaxies. So in the subquantum kinetics cosmology, you don't have any expansion of the universe. The galaxies are not moving away from us. It's just the light that's losing energy as it travels. This is pretty much a requirement of the physics. If this wasn't the case, it would cause problem for the theory. So I went and tested it. I took cosmology data and I plotted the Big Bang interpretation of the redshift and compared it to this tired light interpretation. And on every test, I tried four different tests. On every test, the tired light prediction came closer to the data. And I published this in the Astrophysical Journal, 1986, and it created quite a stir among astronomers. I got letters from some fairly well-known astronomers, including astronomers that were with their National Academy of Sciences in Canada and France and so on. And these were of the group who didn't believe in Big Bang theory. You know, not all astronomers believe in Big Bang. And they considered this quite a step forward because here you could, you pretty much disprove the Big Bang theory with this, showing with data that the expanding universe theory was not very well supported.
Well, now, if the light is tired, would that show that it's coming from a great distance, so the quasars are farther away?
Well, with quasars, you can also have a reddening of the light due to the fact that they're spewing out cosmic ray electrons. And if light goes through a very dense field of electrons, even cosmic ray electrons, it will exchange energy with the electrons and lose energy to the electrons. There's experiments that have been done that show that. It's seen in the case of the sun. When starlight goes through the limb of the sun, there's a lot of ionized gas and electrons there. The light is redshifted. So you can imagine in the case of a quasar, you get redshifting because of that effect. You also get redshifting because the quasar could be altering the gravity field around it. So you're getting light that's coming deep from within its gravity potential well. That's called the gravitational redshift.
So
there's a large number of effects. It's not just cosmological.
That would explain it. It has to, because it's so active, it must be a very heavy core, and the light's coming out of that heavy core, et cetera.
Right. In fact, at one time they thought quasars were an entirely different class of object. But with the Hubble telescope, they were able to see that they're really just normal spiral galaxies, in some cases very massive, with very massive cores, with active cores. In fact, the core is so active that it outshines the light of the galaxy, and that's why we have the name quasar. Quasi-stellar object is what quasar means. Now, our galaxy is more, if it were exploding, let's say we're looking at our galaxy from a distance, from millions of light years away, and the core started to explode, that would alter its appearance to what we call a Seyfert galaxy. So Seyfert galaxies are spiral galaxies that are going through their explosive phase. And it's something like between 15 and 20% of the spiral galaxies that we see fall in this category. So that doesn't give us make us feel too great, you know, that a galaxy spends 15, 20% of its time in this state where, you know, we'd have to be weathering a galactic storm. But that's the reality we have to live with, I guess.
So I guess the steady state theory had something. It just didn't have the mechanism for replenishing the in and out part. It still had the conservation of energy. So now that you have this this model of going in and out, that who knows the real age of our galaxy? I mean, it could be humongously older.
Right. In my book, I talk about the age of stars, and in fact, astronomers have it backwards. The very massive stars are actually some of the oldest stars, because stars grow. You know, you see, in a continuous creation cosmology, a star will grow from a red dwarf up to the mass of our star and keep growing until it gets to, like, let's say 100 solar masses, and at that point it starts ejecting its atmosphere. It's a whole different cosmology. And you find there were certain predictions that came out of this that have been verified. I would guess our own galaxy could be much older than the age that astronomers give for the universe. Because you see, you're limited. With the Big Bang Theory, the age of the universe is limited to around 15 to 20 billion years. But with this continuous creation cosmology, it's a whole new ballgame. You could have a universe that's a trillion years old.
But I've got some questions in here about for your comments on CERN, and I guess one of the areas would be: do you think CERN can actually open up some kind of a new universe or something, or create some black hole that'll swallow the Earth? Or, I mean, from what I understand of the physics behind it, is if a black hole is created, it'd be so small that it would evaporate prior to doing much damage. But then now we're talking about not even having black holes. So would something catastrophic be created in a CERN environment?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that you can form black holes, that black holes are not formed in nature, first of all. Even Einstein was against the idea of singularities. He wrote that in his Scientific American paper in 1954. The black hole idea was invented later by other people. In these core explosions, we never see matter falling in. Like you'd need for a black hole, you'd need to have it gobble matter in order to release energy. All the cores that we observe, they're spewing out matter. Ralph Hawking has talked about we could be seeing the part that's ripped out and spewed out. But there are cases where there's stars that are, or cores that are active that are not surrounded by dust. So that causes a real big problem with the black hole theory. So I don't believe that there's anything to worry about at CERN as far as forming the course.
How about like dimensional stuff? With in your theory, you also talk about multiple dimensions, I believe. But they're still working under relativity when they talk about possibly opening up dimensions?
Yeah, I think they're still talking in the relativistic framework. And also in physics, reverse time is a possibility. And that's why you have people talking about time travel to the past and so on. In subquantum kinetics, time is unidirectional. Doesn't mean that, you could theoretically leave the physical world to a higher dimension of space. That's what we'd call, I think everyone does that at time of death. I think, you know, the actual universe in the big sense, big universe, is higher dimensional. I believe, I won't put my beliefs on the audience. So, let's say that it opens up the possibility for existence outside the physical state.
Yeah. Okay. Now, did you say something about the galaxy heliosphere is shaping, being shaped into a ribbon? I have a question about that. About if you know why our galaxy's heliosphere is shaping into a ribbon. Is that the incoming energy that's kind of pushing it? I seem to have missed this comment.
But you use the word ribbon. That implies a strip. Where did you read about that?
Well, somebody was passed me a link that goes in through the chat room, and they have the two Voyager ships are now taking a picture of the sun heliosphere, and there is a ribbon shape into it. I don't know if it's a high energy area making this ribbon, but then I think the question is more geared toward a non-spherical. I don't know if it's a toroid. Maybe that's a better word to use than ribbon, but this is what the person mentioned. They used the word ribbon, so I don't know if there's a...
I haven't seen that to really comment on it.
Okay. The source, I guess, is from...
Yes. There is something strange in the Crab Nebula that looks sort of, you could call a ribbon or a hatchet or something, a tube, I guess, sticking out from the nebula, which is very unreal. It's not something you normally expect to see in nature. It's sort of a tubular structure. It's called a jet. Crab Nebula chat.
See, I always thought when I see these pictures of the alleged black holes, they have these jets around them, and then people start talking about wormholes and all that, and the wormhole maybe sending out data in and out. So was all that gone too? The whole idea of wormholes and teleporting and ending up in different parts of space and time.
Well, teleportation might still be a possibility. With subquantum kinetics, it allows dematerialization or rematerialization, because basically all you have to do is control the gravity potential. If you, for example, raise the gravity potential in a certain area, that could cause something to dematerialize or at least become invisible. It could be an explanation for certain UFOs where people have reported seeing them, and then suddenly they become invisible, even though they're still present in that without moving. So it allows some unusual effects still. But, you know, when you start talking about teleportation, that's a little beyond my technical experience as to how to accomplish that.
Okay. You also talk about the energy levels of hydrogen, that the energy I don't know if you're referring to, like, we'll call the valence shells or whatnot, that there are lower levels that the electrons can go down, thus giving off energy that might be explained for some of the free energy effects of working with hydrogen and so on?
Right. Yeah, there's energy levels below the ground state. The ground state energy level, which is accepted in physics, there are other orbits that the electron can get into below that level. And there are some researchers who have succeeded in learning how it's possible to encourage the electron to drop into those lower orbits and give off energy. Randall Mills in the U.S., who works with Black Light Corporation, he's got generators that are, I guess, 50-kilowatt heat generators based on this. And then fellow in England, John Eccles, the inventor there, and both of them talk about orbital levels below the ground state. And Eccles has given his patent to a company that claims they can have a water heater out in a year and a half based on this. But this is also predicted by subquantum kinetics.
All right, so once we've taken an energy away, can it absorb it back up? Does it still work in reverse the same way? It goes up and down?
I believe the energy can be recycled. Like, if you took this,
Let's hold there, because we're going to go to the break, and we'll come back and talk. We're talking with Paul LaViolette about, we started out with his super waves, and of course, if you read into his work, it's all interconnected into a whole new physics at looking at the universe that actually explains it. We'll be right back after this.
When you hear the word addiction, perhaps you think of extremes such as alcoholics and heroin addicts. But actually, millions of people are walking around with brain chemistry that causes feelings of sadness, emptiness, and emotional pain that have driven people to be addicted to tobacco, food, and even TV. Anything to momentarily divert the attention from those feelings, at whatever cost. And prescribed drugs are often many times more dangerous and addictive than the symptoms they aim to treat. AddictionSupplements.com have proven supplements that supply the brain with the nutrients it needs to naturally rebalance the biochemical system, which is the real cure for the real cause. AddictionSupplements.com has cutting-edge supplements designed by real science and real doctors, such as Dr. Charles Gant, MD. Interested in turning your life around? Point your browser to AddictionSupplements.com.
Are you getting your greens? In today's busy world, greens often consist of the lettuce on a fast food hamburger. And even people who are health conscious and drink high quality pre or post workout protein shakes miss their greens all the same. Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Innerfood by Inner Health Botanicals. Innerfood promotes health and boosts energy with nature's finest superfoods. Innerfood is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Innerfood helps you fight an acidic body pH, which has been shown to lead to poor health and even cancer. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Innerfood is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, innerstreamsradio.com, and click on any Inner Health Botanical banner and you're ready to order. Innerfood, building health from the insides out.
I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio and creator and host of Feet to the Fire. Have you ever noticed the high volume of commercials on most talk shows? It is to the point that it seems like topics are the bait and the guests are the fillers to sell products. I've made a conscious decision to keep disruptions to a minimum and provide more uninterrupted time for the real reason you tuned in. You hear guests with more time to make their points, allowing me and listeners to intuitively, intelligently formulate questions by having less interruptions to break the stream of consciousness. The commercials that are heard are thus presented in a more receptive and fertile environment for consideration. If you have goods or services that you feel can benefit our audience, please let us know. Email me direct at james@innersights.com or call us toll-free at 888-863-2722.
Feet to the Fire may be free to listen to, but it is not free to provide. Let us help us to get your message out as you help us to get ours.
Make sure you stay tuned, because you're listening to Feet to the Fire.
Could you feed your family for a year, 2 years, or more from your garden if you had to? Do you have the right kind of seeds? Can you save your seeds from your harvest to plant next year? Heirloom Organics non-hybrid seed packs are a sustainable gardening choice of home, homestead, and professional gardeners throughout North America. Heirloom Organics seed packs are designed with your specific space, light, and nutritional needs in mind. A one-pound selection of 22 seed varieties that can feed two people for a year for just $99. Got a family? The family pack has 27 seed varieties to feed a family of four. There's even a homestead pack that has 31 varieties of seeds to feed eight people for 1 year for under $250. And don't forget, these are organically grown and 100% non-genetically modified. And forget the Terminator gene that prevents you from saving seeds for next year's crop. The heirloom organic seeds can be harvested and saved from each generation to be planted the next year. Just go to our website at feedtofire.com and click on the heirloom ad to access a lifetime of natural nutrition and wholesome eating the way it was meant to be.
People on the earth, can you hear me? Came a voice from the sky on a magical night. And in the colors of a thousand sunsets, they travel to the world on a silvery light. People out there stood waiting, watching as the ships came one by one. Setting fire to the sky as they landed, carrying to the world children of the sun. Children of the sun. Inside, the beam of light hit the ground.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose direct chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at F2F at innersights.com. That's F2F at INNERSITES.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancey.
All right, we are back talking to Paul LaViolette. He's a physicist, system engineer, cosmologist. He's got a lot of hats. And what's interesting is that where he's coming from with his own personal explanation for how the world works in the creation aspect sense, dealing with his kinetic system, it kind of explains everything, and yet, but it, since it explains it in such a difficult, different way than the standard theories, people who kind of make their living or their life in these standing theories get a little wiggly. But we like talking about these things, and welcome back to the show, Paul.
Hi.
We have a bunch of questions that have come in that are going to be, well, I would use the term off the wall in that they're asking for your opinions about subjects that you might not have, you know, factual data on. I mean, like, because you're a scientist, you've put together your theories, but we like to also hear what you think or believe, you know, just coming from you. And for example, someone wants to know what you think about the Hopi beliefs.
Yeah, I write about that in my book, Earth Under Fire, which talks about this galactic superwave phenomenon. And I talk a little about the stories from the Indian legends, how they were led by a cloud or by day, a light by night, certain places where they were taking shelter underground. So it seems they may have had some ET visitation that was trying to help out for them to survive the event. This is perhaps a prehistoric story dating back from the last ice age. We have no way of knowing for sure. But it's interesting, they talk about the appearance of the blue-white star, Sakwasaha. And this is what you would see when the galactic core became active. We see the same bluish-white light coming from the cores of active galaxies, but we need telescopes to see them. You know, in the case of our own galaxy, you wouldn't need a telescope. It might even be bright enough to see during the day.
Now, with our suns, let's say stars, they would be smaller versions, but would they have the same effects? I mean, for example, would a supernova in a star be the same kind of an event, only since it's so small by comparison that it might destroy itself?
In that case, the star is destroyed, whereas the core ejects part of itself, but the majority of the core remains. You can have, for example, whole clusters of stars being ejected in a core explosion. If we look towards the galactic center, we see star clusters that are moving away from the galactic core as if they've been ejected at some time in the past. This is difficult to understand in current physics, which talks about black holes. But you go a little further back, like William McCrae, astronomer from UK, and then even further back, Sir James Jeans. They were talking about the cores of galaxies being centers of creation, and they arrived at their conclusions based on observation. So it's interesting. You have people coming to the same idea from the observational side, and then subquantum kinetics predicts it from the theoretical side.
Well, I would assume then that the model that the sun is creating its energy through fusion, it would be not accurate then. That is
right. With subquantum kinetics, it predicts a new form of energy. Actually, it's something I've named genic energy. Basically, you remember earlier we were talking about the redshifting of photons from other galaxies. Mm-hmm. In subquantum kinetics, photons redshift in intergalactic space because the gravity potential is much higher in intergalactic space. Whereas in our own galaxy and in other galaxies, we're in a gravity well, and that alters the conditions of the ether. this may sound arbitrary just as I explain it, but it's actually quite rigorous. This is a prediction that if this didn't happen, it would make a serious problem for subquantum kinetics. So a key prediction that came out of subquantum kinetics is that photons traveling in the galaxy would blue shift instead of red shift, so just the opposite of the cosmological red shift. And in the case of the sun, so if you look at the sun, you know, it's a huge reservoir of photons. And if their energy, the energy of each of those photons is increasing over time by a very small amount, you end up, by the time you add up all the photons, you can have quite a large amount of energy. In the case of the sun, I believe the contribution from this effect is about 10% of the sun's energy, maybe 15% at the most. But in lower mass stars like red dwarfs, it accounts for all the energy. And one of the giveaways about this is if you plot the mass of a star against its luminosity, something that Eddington discovered, the stars follow this sequence. The more mass of the star, the greater its luminosity, and they form a sequence. But there's a place where this trend line breaks, like a little less massive than the sun, the trend line suddenly bends upward, and that's why the sun, it's on the what's called the upper main sequence, whereas red dwarfs are on the lower main sequence. You know, so why is there this break? Well, it's due to the onset of nuclear fusion. So prior to that, at lower mass stars where fusion doesn't work, you have just the stars being powered by genic energy. And that's a totally new concept in astronomy. And I did test this. I predicted if this was true, you should find that planets like Jupiter and Saturn should also lie on the same trend line. And as I started researching this, I found, in fact, that they are putting out thermal energy. And when you plot them, they do fall on the same line. And that's something that's not predicted by standard physics.
Are you aware of the theory, and I'm trying to remember his name, he's actually a comic book writer, not Stan Lee or anything like that, I can't think of his name offhand, it'll come to me. He has a theory that the world is expanding, and he has his proofs for that. Could the Earth also be a creator as well?
Yes, in fact, the geothermal energy, I believe, is almost, well, some part of it could be due to radioactive decay in the crust, but there's a large part of the thermal flux from the Earth that they don't have a good explanation for where it comes from. And genic energy predicts this unexplained amount. So when we look at a volcanic eruption, all that energy coming out of the Earth, we can figure maybe 70% of that might be due to genic energy. Same in, the same for the creation of matter. Just like the sun and the core of the galaxy would be growing, in fact, creating matter inside, matter produces more matter. In other words, matter is arising from the zero-point fluctuations, and in the gravity well that we're in the galaxy, there's a tendency for matter to nucleate. And as a result, even the Earth would be growing, but very slowly. You can put restrictions on how fast the Earth would grow, because if you project similar rates to the sun, if the sun were to be growing, it would be coming gradually more luminous. And so you go back and hit time, let's say a billion years ago, you figure the climate couldn't have been too much different on Earth. So that puts some restrictions on how fast this growth is. But it certainly is, I think, what some theorists talk about, where the Earth was half its size several hundred million years ago, I think are a little extreme.
Okay, all right. Well, another question is if we can get into. I've been interested in the Fatima and the appearances of Mary Garbandal and the warnings. And what I'm interested in is that the description of the events that would happen sound like it might be a CME event, where you're talking about the it's sort of like the atmosphere is on fire. We've had remote viewers on here talk about an event that's coming where they can't describe it because it's something that has not happened in that they can't explain consciously, where you have some type of a fireball or a burning of the atmosphere in some way. And I'm wondering if that, you know, some have even said that the appearances of Mary are actually ETs. I had guests on about that. So I'm wondering if this Garbandal event might be a warning from, well, be it angels or ETs, of an incoming wave that would set off the sun.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's referring to the super wave. And it's the Fatima prophecy, visions of Garbandal indicate this is something that's going to happen very shortly. And closer we get to 2012, you get more and more people coming out saying that they're being told or they have some a telepathic contact with beings that are warning them that, of this impending disaster. Even I learned myself when I was being interviewed on the Camelot project that now the Bill and Carrie Cassidy, they have information from one contact who claims that the Black Projects have known about this and are predicting that something will happen by 2017.
Well, you know, and this has nothing that, this comment is not made in any way derogatory whatsoever, but what I like about what you're doing is that some of these people who have come forward with these leaks have nothing, absolutely nothing to back up their claims, not even their own personal reputation. And yet when you come up with your stuff, not only does it, you have these like math and science behind it, not only in your background, I mean, you can verify where you've been and what you know, and then you have all these books and predictions done. I mean, that's why when you start talking about galactic waves coming in and all this like that, it makes a whole heck of a lot more credible because you can sit down and explain how it works, why it happens, what's the evidence for past ones, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, I did my PhD on the superwave theory, so I had to pretty much sort of very rigorously define it and look. I did quite a bit of searching for data to see was there evidence of this, and the data indicated there was. In fact, the superwave theory has itself made something like 14 predictions that were later verified. So it's done pretty well.
And that's why I'm very impressed with what's going on here, is because I listened, I've been doing this in my seventh year, and I've been listening to like Art Bell back since the 90s. And there's been a lot of people who've come out and said things, but they don't have anything to back them up. I mean, I understand if you're a whistleblower, a lot of times you don't have much to do it because you're sneaking out, but you're going to have your own personal background to be in the position to whistleblow. And a lot of the people who have done these things, they have no background. I mean, in fact, I was just talking the last few weeks that there were one of the whistleblowers that was put out there was saying that we have roadblocks and we're all going to be vaccinated or taken away to prison on the 15th. You know, and I come on here and say, well, it's impossible. I mean, their infrastructure's not there. I mean, they don't even have enough vaccinations. I mean, I looked at it logically and went through it all, and of course it didn't happen. But that's some of the problems when I hear data on these various sites is they're not really, I mean, it's just words coming out. So that's why I'm really excited to get in and read your books, because you not only do you have You have the backup on many different ways. Unprecedented, actually, as far as I've been interviewing over the years, what you are saying and how you are saying it and what you're backing up with is virtually unprecedented with, you know, credibility on from every angle. So I'm pretty excited. I mean, not that I love to have a gravity wave happen hit tomorrow, but, you know, I mean, it's kind of stimulating in searching for truth. Speaking of gravity waves, one thing you mentioned was that that the tsunami we had was a severe earthquake, and that sure a couple days after that we had a large gamma ray burst or a cosmic ray burst, and that seems to fit your model of a gravity wave preceding the gamma ray, even though this was a local event as opposed to a galactic center explosion, but it kind of gave a little bit of a working model of the wave.
Yeah, I wrote about that on my website, which is etheric.com. After a few months after it happened, the scientific community finally released the information about the gravity about the gamma ray burst, which is a little disconcerting. Why would they keep something so phenomenal secret for so long? They were waiting, and I guess until their papers got accepted, I don't know. But we really can't wait around for announcements of major effects like that. Because, for example, that one even affected the satellites. This was the first time we had a gamma ray burst within our galaxy. Most of them are originating from outside our galaxy, from very far away. So this was quite close by, and it was the most intense burst to have been seen in the history of astronomy, of looking for gamma ray bursts. And it's interesting that just 2 days before that was the worst earthquake that had been anywhere on the planet for 30, 40 years. And if you look at the probabilities, you know, it's very small chance that it wasn't related.
Yeah, that is, it is, that is pretty. I remember when, you know, when it came out and they talked in retrospect, I mean, it kind of struck. Before we're going to run out of time in a little bit, and I have so many questions people have said in there. First, I want to mention etheric.com, also starburstfound.org. I have links to the books, which I think I'm going to get really into on there as well. I have a direct link that you can just click, etheric.com/books.html. They can go right to it, because I understand that the Amazon link, some of them are out of date. So I got that on there. And perhaps if I can squeeze in, do you have something coming up that you would want to promote before I...
Well, there's the Project Camelot interview. That goes for 2 hours and 20 minutes, something like that. You can... there's a link to the streaming video on YouTube on at the top of my etheric.com webpage. You can also download it from the Project Camelot site.
Okay, and actually, when I put up the archives, I'm going to link to that. It's been excellent having you here. Perhaps at some point you can come back and continue. Maybe in closing, could you? I'm looking over these questions. One was very, I don't know if you can answer it in a minute, but apparently you tried to stop the launch of the Columbia and prevent the disaster, but they wouldn't listen to you. What brought you to
I was trying to tell them about this technology that could avoid the heating of the skin.
I see.
And I just couldn't get them to start investigating this. It's something that had already been developed. All the research had been done by aerospace companies.
Unfortunately,
that was the one thing that if they had done something about it, that was 10 years later, they had that accident.
Have you ever seen or witnessed any what you would say UFOs?
I never have myself. Okay. Friends of mine have.
Well, you know,
I've heard some really amazing stories, believe me.
Well, I want to try to sneak as much as I can in, but we're going to be out of time here, and I don't want to rush off. Again, I appreciate you coming by, and perhaps another point we can talk some more. And
sure.
I will bury myself in your books
See, I have dyslexia, I have tough reading, so that's why I was kind of asking before about the audiobooks, because I just soak up that stuff like crazy. And I love it. So I appreciate it, and look forward to talk to you again, and looking forward to some more of your work.
Okay, thank you, James.
Thank you very much.
Enjoyed being here.
Thank you. All right. Well, there we go. We'll be back next week. Lord willing, the creek don't rise, and the galaxy doesn't go pop. Well, I say you got to go someday. You might as well go in a nice bang. I don't want to get cooked, though, but I would like to see the show. Anyway, we'll be back live next week. Reach for the skies within. We'll see you.
Retell your timeless truths. Oh, each one.
Feet to Fire is a production of IPS Media Works on the ONSIC Radio Network of Stations.